Welcome to the latest episode of Inspiring Futures. My guest today is Taz Tzolopoulos. Is that right? Did I absolutely bastardize your name? You can give That's us a, give us the proper pronunciation.
I think you overthought it.
And so don't worry about it. Taz is fine. I always say Taz is fine. I grew up in England. Don't worry about the surname.
Taz is a planner on McDonald's at One Kennedy here in New York. Do you have an official title?
Yes, officially I am Global Strategy Director on McDonald's.
Great, that's awesome. So let's go way back. I'm going to ask you some questions about, so you said you were born in Greece, but you moved to England when you were young?
Yes, indeed. So born in Greece, fully Greek. Those that know Greeks know how Greek every Greek is. So Greek household, both Greek parents, but we did move to London when I was 2/3. So I did grow up in London, but in a very Greek household. You know, my mum would say, you walk outside that door, it's a foreign country. It's basically a wasteland, a moral wasteland. And you know, they're not like us and all that, you know, immigrant stuff. So what I appreciate is that I went to English schools. I didn't go to like the Greek school and be Greek. You know, that would have been, I think, too Greek. I also
was it North London where you lived?
No, we weren't in a Greek area either. We were in, you know, Southwest London, East Sheen. Shout out to East Sheen.
Yep.
So again, surrounded by no Greeks.
Yep.
I went to school in central London, where someone uncharitably asked me to name 10 famous Greeks. And before I was about to start the list, they said, no, they have to be alive, which is harder to name 10 famous alive Greeks. Dead Greeks, we got loads.
Yeah. Thousands
of years ago. Yeah. So again, you know, it's just to give you an idea of the mindset, right? Like, I never felt British, never felt English growing up, felt very Greek, but also loved England and loved English people, and all my friends were English and et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah.
So how did you decide that advertising was going to be where you launched your career?
Good question. I knew nothing about advertising. Apart from, I kind of liked ads growing up. So I was a good consumer of the product, but never imagined myself in it, mainly because I thought, well, I was never good at art, so I can't draw. So why would I even think about advertising? You got to draw stuff, right? I did a, went to Bristol University, politics, economics. I did a master's at LSE in, again, European political economy. So again, advertising was far off. I'd done some internships in finance. And if my parents listen to this, they're going to be upset at this point because they really wanted me to go into finance. Again, Greek parents, you know, finance, law, or doctor is the only thing, you know, and that's the same. Exactly. That's the same with a lot of parents, but especially true of, you know, your Greek parents. I gave it a shot. I did two banking internships. I've spent basically two whole summers doing these internships and realized really did not want to work in finance or banking. It just felt too narrow for me as a focus.
When you went to LSE, so you were doubling down on your politics.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, I was fascinated.
What did you think when you went there? What were you imagining that you'd come out of there doing?
That's a great question that I don't think I've thought about for a while. Like, I went there without a clear idea of what I wanted to do coming out, but it definitely wasn't advertising. You know, maybe I was still toying with the idea of finance. Maybe, I mean, politics was something, was definitely an ambition later down the line, but I always thought, well, you should do something first before going into politics. So I never imagined trying to be a work for, you know, research for an MP or something.
maybe the, you know, international relations, some element of that would be interesting. Definitely not advertising. And also the advertising portion of the careers office at LSE, at least then, was almost non-existent, right? I went to ask them once and they laughed. But I'll tell you why I entered it. Had a friend from school who said to me, I'm going to go to this talk for advertising. I said, I always thought it was interesting, but you know, I'm not good at art. And he said, oh, don't be silly. Just I think you find it interesting. Come see this thing. And it was funny enough, the only advertising company I knew, probably beyond Saatchi & Saatchi, I'd also heard of WPP, because I was at LSE reading the FT, and the only one they talk about is WPP and stuff. So I said, okay, look, I'll come. You know, what have I got to lose? And there was Jeremy Bullmore, legendary Jeremy Bullmore, was giving the, and it was about for the WPP fellowship. And in that they said, we're looking for the kind of people that like reading every section of the newspaper. And I still make this point to young people now. I make the joke, you know, you might not know what newspaper is. Think about a website. But that for me was that light bulb moment where I went, oh, there's a job for people that do that, because that's still probably my, you know, my Saturday afternoon is reading every section of the newspaper. Like, it's still my pastime. And it was then. And I went, oh, that's interesting. You know, it just made me see advertising in a totally different way. Like, it's not just about drawing stuff. It's about having a broad range of interests that you can apply to, you know, whatever category or business problem you're working on. So that sort of inspired the initial interest. I went to my local library at that point, which I hadn't done again for about 20 years, and just went, oh, books on advertising. And I got, you know, John Steele, Truth, Lies and Advertising was really significant, because that was the one I read first. And I went, oh my God, this is it. This is what I want to be. And then I read, you know, Ogilvy on Advertising, a load of advertising books. And at that point, I was like, all right, this is it. This is the career I want. It was as simple as that.
What happened next?
Well, what happened next? What was interesting?
And God, I do like talks. So I feel half of this is already, you know, we haven't even got into me getting hired yet, but I'm sure you can edit it. So
WPP was the driver for me first, you know, and I
went on the IPA website, which they helpfully at the time had all the grad schemes.
And I realized by the
time I logged on, every grad scheme had already closed, apart from WPP.
And Ogilvy.
And
BBH. And so I went, well, I know WPP because I read the FT, and I know Ogilvy because I just read Ogilvy on Advertising. I've never heard of BBH. Who are they? But then when I went on their website, I went, oh,
they did that. Oh, they did Levi's. They did Boddington's. They did Axe, Lynx. They did Johnny Walker. So I realized this agency I'd never heard of actually had sort of
created the 90s largely.
When I said I was a consumer of advertising, a lot of that consumption was stuff BBH had made. Plus, Johnny Walker was huge in Greece. Keep Walking. Where I was going, obviously, every summer. So I went, oh, okay, well, they're interesting as well. I'll definitely apply there. And they were the only one that, and that was probably the one I was least excited about, because I was, oh, WPP.
But then
once I read into it, I went, oh, that's the one. And then again, very lucky to make it onto their grad scheme and started, yeah, you know, nearly 20 years ago now as a grad.
When you got into their graduate program, did they throw you around different departments, or did they put you in a department? How did it work?
They did. It was an amazing, it was such a privilege.
It was 3 months of just training, of learning, like a crash course in advertising run by the people who had made those ads. Because again, so many of the legends were still there. Everyone from Bogle, Hegarty down, you know, the Jim Carrolls of the world, the Kev Browns, the Nick Kendalls in terms of planning, some of the legendary creatives, Nick Gill. I mean, again, it was incredible. And we were just there. There were three of us, and we would just get these classes by these absolute legends. And then they got you to rotate through every department. I did routing, if anyone now probably doesn't know what that is, but signing off, you know, print ads, which was awesome. And then, so planning was the one, you know, having read John Steele, I said, well, this is the role that I want to do. But at the time, BBH wanted you to start in account management because you would get a better feel for, I guess, how the sausage is made and every step of the process. And so I started as an account man.
And then I had a
great boss who was very strategic, and he was an account director. And I went, well, he's very strategic and he's an account guy. So I don't know, maybe account is the thing, you know. And then I was like, well, now I want to be account director in a few years. And I just got caught up in the sort of career progression within the role and enjoying the role. I was enjoying the role. And I didn't really think twice. I went, okay, maybe I can just be an account guy. And that was it. I stayed an account guy for 5 years.
What were you working on as an account guy?
So my sort of formative years were Vodafone, which was awesome. I mean, again, so
I was always a bit of a technology nerd. And so what was amazing then was like the phone, and again, this is a sort of legendary bit of strategy by Jim Carroll. When they pitched it, which I wasn't part of, he kind of said, look, phase one of the mobile phone is distance, right? We bring people together that are far apart. And BBH, if you remember back in the day, had done these awesome one-to-one ads, right? Who would you want to have a one-to-one at? And it was about talk. I mean, talk was the only thing it offered at the time. But by 2005, when I started working with them, these new innovations were coming up, right? And they said, you know, mobile email is an innovation that's coming. Yeah, BlackBerry had just started. Mobile internet, right? I did an ad that is basically launching the mobile internet, which makes me feel very old. And anyone that's, you know, Gen Z on this will be like, oh my God, there was a time before the internet wasn't mobile. And ironically, the ad we did that was the sort of big global launch spot was all about how you take all these moments of dead time, beautifully narrated by Judi Dench, beautifully shot by Ringan Ledwidge, rest in peace. And it was this, and again, genius idea by Nick Gill, who basically said, think about an average day. There's all these dead moments, right? When you're waiting for the bus, when you're waiting for the ATM, when you're just hanging around in a park waiting for your friend to arrive. So let's do these vignettes where this girl in a red jumpsuit is waiting for stuff. And then he literally cut out the pages and he was just doing this on his floor. You know, Nick Gill, again, extraordinary sort of creative in action. And he's asking for me for more bits of paper. He's like, give me some bits of paper. And he's drawing out these frames, and then he cuts them together and he creates a flip book. And he goes, look, if you take the same frames of these scenes of boredom, and then you just fast forward them quicker and quicker and quicker, the girl's doing a cartwheel. And he literally did that in front of me. And I go, oh my God. And then he said, oh, get me ringing on the phone. And, you know, and so that became cartwheel. But the irony that, and it was, I think it was a really smart message, right? It's like what this mobile internet can do is it can take your boring time and make it interesting. You know, Vodafone. Now, unfortunately, we can't have a single second that isn't interesting, and we are always making life,
yep,
you know, interesting on the phone. And I wish we could kind of maybe we could do a spot to reverse the cartwheel, and she slows down a bit and is like, oh, you know what? It's quite nice to just sit in the park.
Maybe it's an ad for boredom.
It's an ad for boredom.
Bring boredom back.
Bring boredom back. Well, what's unfortunate is like, the message we had was right, fill the boring time. The problem is when you're filling the time that wasn't boring and you're with your friend, but you're still on your phone. That's where...
That's a real problem.
It went too far.
So you how do you raise your hand and say, I love this account management stuff, but I want to be a planner?
Yes, good question.
It's a hard thing to do, isn't it?
It was hard, especially when you're sort of established in a place. It's the only place you've ever worked. Everyone knows you as like, he's the go-to. My old boss used to call me Maverick because it was like, he'll get shit done, right? Like, Tass will do it. Nothing's too hard. So by that time, I was on Johnny Walker, which again, amazing account to go from Vodafone, make the most of now, to Johnny Walker, keep walking. Again, big
big inspirational brand platforms, high order brand platforms.
Had they done the big? It was originally a training video, wasn't it, or something? The Robert Carlyle, has that?
Has that been already? 8-minute film. Yeah. That happened as I joined the account. That was sort of in its early days. So that launched as I was on it, but I can't take any credit for that. My friend Ruben, who lives in New York, produced that. So respect to Ruben. And obviously Justin Moore as well, legendary copywriter at Wyden, at BBH, who made that. So I
was loving the job. And also back to the Greek thing, see, it keeps cropping up.
What's crazy is that Greece, tiny Greece, at the time, so this was
probably 2009, 2010,
was the largest per capita market in the world for Johnny Walker by far, like per capita terms, by far the largest. But in even just absolute terms, they were the fifth largest
market.
So this is after the US, you know, Malaysia, huge countries.
And then you had Greece. So, and that's why when I applied to BBH and I went, oh, Johnny Walker, I'd never seen any of that work in the UK. But Greece, you couldn't move for seeing Keep Walking ads everywhere, right? People would have tattoos of Keep Walking. People in a political demonstration would have Keep Walking signs. So they used Greece as a kind of as a testing ground for, like, we know the no one knows the brand better than Greeks, so like let's test these, like, let's run these ads. And when the Greeks heard that there was a Greek on the UK team in London, they were, oh, the Greek, oh, we want to work with the Greek guy. So it was awesome. I now start going to Greece for work. I remember launching a campaign in Greece, and again in a very Greek way, they said, would you like to invite anyone? I literally invited about 10 or 15 members of my family. It was like aunts, uncles, cousins. The only people missing were my parents, unfortunately, who lived in England, and my sister. So again, the whole family came, very, very proud moment. But there was something about the work for me that
wasn't proving
rewarding enough, like
intellectually rewarding, intellectually
stimulating. I felt
the job of an account manager, and
I'm not dissing any account people, it's like you have to spin so many plates and you have to be in so many parts of the process and you have to drive. I like the leadership style. I like the leadership aspect of account management. I like the, you know, we can do this, the bring the team with you, being the sort of, you know, but I never felt I was contributing enough of me. Like, this is my bit of thinking. You know, what's your bit of thinking? This is my bit of thinking. And I kind of needed that. And I started talking to some planners, you know, in BBH, legendary plans, and again was encouraged to be like, look, you know, if you feel that you're going to be happier here, then you should do it. So I was lucky that I was able to
switch
to be a planner on Johnny Walker while also being an account man. So it was like 50-50. I was doing some account stuff and some planning, and then started taking on other accounts that where I was
strictly an account guy.
And then there came a point where, yeah, strictly a planner. And then there came a point where it was like, all right, you know, you're coming off Johnny Walker and you just be a planner on this account.
So that was the sort of transition.
Now the bit that was hard, especially when I'm on the
same account, and this is, you know, just advice to anyone that
wants to make the switch. And I say to people, whether it's, you know,
people I work with directly or people I mentor, like, you will need to move back in order to move
forwards, right? Like, I was a 5-year account man. There's no way I'm going to be a 5-year planner. So, and I did find that hard. Like, I remember saying to a boss,
I said, look, I used to be at the top table and
now I feel I'm not even in the room.
And she was like, yeah, I'm
afraid that's how it works, right? You want to change roles. You're not account director anymore. So that was hard. And I think, you know, that plus just, again, establishing myself as a planner, like there was a reason a few years later why
it just felt for me
that the next step in my career would be to go somewhere else. As much as I love BBH, again, it will always be a very special place. And I'd never even looked at, I've never even met a headhunter, let alone speak to one, for about 8 years of being there. Just felt I need to go somewhere where I arrive and it's like Tass is the planner on this account, or the, you know, the planning director, etc. So
that's when you came to the States?
And that's when I came to the States, because once I started looking in London and you know, met some recruiters and stuff, New York had always been, again, people ask me, people still ask me now, I've been here 10 years, oh, why are you in New York? And I say, look, it's, I don't know. I think it's you know, largely the result of Ghostbusters, Home Alone 2, these 80s
Friends.
Movies. Friends is a later point, but absolutely Friends built some of that. I'll find old movies and I'll be like, oh my God, New York features it. Of course, there was that part in that where I, but it these formative years. I went to the Grace Building the other day. Do you know the Grace Building on Bryant Park? The curved one, right? Beautiful.
And I'd never been in it.
And I was, oh my God, I'm in this building. And I remember, I think there's a scene in Ghostbusters where the ghosts are in the lobby of this stunning like skyscraper. But as a wide-eyed little 8-year-old or 6-year-old, New York just was the place. And so
you've been here as a kid. You've been here to visit.
I'd admired it as a kid, desperate to visit. I'd finally persuaded my parents when I was about 15 to take me here. I had then since come a few times. My dad used to come for work once a year. So I sort of hopped on a few times, tagged along, forced myself to tag along. And then, yeah, it was the thing. And I talked about it for years. There's actually a friend of mine, not in advertising, who eventually said at one point in about 2012, he's like, Tass, you've been talking about New York for years, but you're not going to do it, mate. You haven't been. You're not going to go. And that maybe was the final push I needed to go. No, F that. I'm gonna go. So,
what did you find? Because you know, you and I are different generations a little bit, but we've both taken that same trip from London to the US. What surprised you most when you started working here? Because to me it's a very, very different advertising language here.
Interesting. To talk more on that, and then, because I'm curious, Carl, I actually didn't find it that different. So
I always you know, because I was in England up until the late 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And the way I always describe sort of English culture was sort of very village-like. It's sort of like Chinese whispers, you know. To me, the best advertising was always the stuff that just sort of somehow inserted itself into that very colloquial sort of conversation, you know, and you know, created a sort of a dialogue. And I think over here it was just such a big country. You know, if you think of GGT and Dave Trott and all the sort of almost Ian Drury isms came out of GGT and so many different brands, it was exactly that. It was idioms, colloquialisms, it was ways of making your brand feel like it was inserted into the world, you know. And here it's so big, it's not a place of nuance.
That's very true.
It's a place of radical simplicity and clarity.
That aspect is very true. Tonally, the advertising is so different.
Yeah.
And there's an element, maybe, and this is interesting, you know, BBH established itself as, you know, this sort of micro network. And again, Hegarty being visual led, art director led, there's something interesting comparing Wieden Kennedy, which is copywriter led, versus BBH, art director led. But there was something, and again, they had the model where we're not in every country, so we are going to make work here. They're one of the sort of pioneers of like regional work, global work, very visual led. Vodafone, which I worked on, was a global account. Not, I didn't work on the UK business. Johnny Walker was global. It ran everywhere other than the UK. So in a way, most of my time at BBH, I never actually made many UK ads. And so then maybe me moving here, the shift didn't feel that dramatic because I was never in the type of advertising you're describing, which I recognize and love, wasn't the kind that I personally had sort of been making. I've never really thought about that before. I'll tell you another thing that struck me, which again goes back to the Greek thing. I'd never felt British really once in 30 years of living in England. I come here. And, you know, if you look at my Instagram, my handles are like Tass the Greek on Instagram, Tass the Greek, you know, Tass the Greek's my email. Come here and then
suddenly, and again,
you can't overdo this. You've had it. You've moved.
It sounds ridiculous to the English people back in England, but people were struck by the accent.
Like they do make a big deal of it. And people are like, oh, my God, we love your accent. And you read that thing and, oh, you know, almost giggling at the English accent or the British, they call it the British accent here, which we know is not actually a thing.
And so suddenly
I'm like Tass the Brit planner,
and British planners are
a brand here in the way that Greek planners are not. And so suddenly the Greek part that had always been front and center, I kind of went, well, maybe I am a little bit British. And oh, you like how I say mum? Okay, let's. So that was striking for me that, you know, identity
maybe for me is more fluid in a way that, you know, than I thought it was before.
Enhances your professional credibility, you see.
That's the thing. So when there's an incentive
to be more fluid and British, then I said, yeah, I'll lean in. And then I guess, you know, it's true of any immigrant. You know, you sort of, I never felt more English till I left England. There's some truth in that for a lot of people, I guess. So and I missed it and stuff. So anyway, yes, that was
is really interesting because I do think there's a sort of an evolution there that you know, sort of the supposedly everything you say sounds smarter.
Yeah.
Right. But you know, we're sort of moving away a little bit from wanting that sort of guru, you know. I think that's very it's sort of very an old kind of mindset. I'd rather be more American than British, to be honest.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. I mean, you are British, right?
Oh yeah.
So then you have, and you've been here longer.
I've been here I've been here 10 years longer than you have.
Okay.
At least, maybe longer.
Yeah. Interesting.
So, but you came here and you worked on some, you know, you were at Saatchi, right? And you're working on some big stuff, right? Some big brand stuff.
My first account here was Cheerios. So the strategy director on Cheerios, which was awesome. Again, like, you know, you can't get more American than sort of big General Mills and cereals in Minnesota.
Flying out, they had to explain to me how cold it is when you go in winter to Minnesota. And then research, like within week two, I was sort of researching like Hispanic
non-acculturated mums in South Central LA.
And I was like, wow, this is awesome, right? This is why I'm here, to explore this massive country and all its sort of nuances. And then we did the Super Bowl spot as well. So we did the first Super Bowl spot they'd done maybe ever. And if you remember, this was now 2014, it would have been so 10 years ago. And it was the interracial girl, which again, it was never designed as a, we're going to make a point about, you know, modern families. It was just the girl, the creative director and the director found a girl that he loved and she was mixed race. And so, you know, the dad and mum, you know, are going to be mixed race naturally. And then there was all this backlash. And there's a lovely story, which I think I won't get in trouble for saying, in that we at the agency never even felt, we didn't even think this is going to be controversial, right? Because we live in New York, and everyone's, you know, in their sort of liberal coastal bubble.
So it wasn't ever a
thing like, oh, this is going to be controversial, but let's do it. General Mills, meanwhile, who had an amazing client who was Camille Gibson, who retired a few years after that.
They did think it was going to be controversial, and they even tested it
without telling us. We found this out at her retirement party, maybe 2 years later.
She was such an amazing client.
She tested it, but didn't tell us because she didn't want to worry us. But the
people at General Mills
were like, oh, we should test this because this might be controversial. And it was polarizing, right? So you got lots of lovers, but there were a significant amount of haters. She went to the president of the...
Big G was like the grain division. And he said, you know, what are the results? And okay, this might cause backlash
against General Mills. But he said, this is your call, right? I'm not going to tell you either one way or the other. And she said, we're going to run it. I don't care. And she didn't even tell us that. So then when there was all this
outrage from
some, you know, sectors,
she expected it. But
we were the ones that were surprised. And it just shows what an amazing client that, like, she didn't even tell us because she didn't want to worry us, but she knew. And she'd even told her boss. So I love, you know, that was a lovely moment.
Yeah. I mean, so easily could have gone another way, right? So
right.
Easily. Yeah.
Right.
So, you know, your learning curve must have been pretty remarkable when you're working on Super Bowl Sport, you travel to Minnesota, you're going to South Central, you are just like,
soaking up.
Yeah. What are you thinking when you're going through this? Is this just like, because you got your America of your movie land, and this is like, oh, this is a little different.
Yeah, yeah. I again, just as a
planner, just soaking it all up. Like the more random a place I could visit to do research, the better, yeah. Right? The more remote, the more suburban, you know, the more like, or looking at different multicultural segment. Like
when we went to meet the mums in South Central who didn't speak English, and I went back, hang on, they've been here
20 years, but they don't, again, it sounds naive.
I went, well, how do they not speak English?
But then you look at the community they're in, and everyone else was from Mexico, and all the shops had Spanish signs. And I went, oh, well, I guess, if
my parents had lived in a
neighborhood in London that were all Greeks, then they probably wouldn't speak English either. Like they wouldn't, they don't like speaking English now. So it was, you know, I'm sort of, yeah, like you say, learning curve. I'm understanding the different dynamics and the nature of this country, and, you know, Midwest versus, I remember my colleagues explaining to me the term Minnesota nice and how nice people were, but how, with a client, it could sometimes be a bad thing because they're so nice. We would say sometimes they would gum work to death, right? They gum it, and eventually they'd spit it out and be like, no, we don't like it. But so
again, just,
you know, just, I guess just love, like, understanding, you know, how people tick and the backgrounds and, you know, the different parts of the country. And, oh, what does that mean when you say he's a Texan, like, versus he's a North Carolinian versus California? But, you know, again, America is so dominant in the, like, sort of global English mass culture, primarily film and TV, that I got an idea of what it means to live in Baltimore because I'm a big fan of The Wire, or got an idea of what North California means versus South California. Yeah, but till you go and experience it, it's not the same.
So what about the differences in strategy departments or planning, and what your relationship, how your relationships work with other people, like account people or creatives? Was there a lot to learn there?
So I think there were differences in
the process. And again, for me, I'd
only ever worked at BBH London.
So I don't even know if the differences were BBH London versus everywhere else, or if it's England. I can't judge what a UK agency is like other than BBH. One thing that was interesting was I expected to work longer hours in New York, but coming out of BBH London, there's nowhere you can go where you're going to work longer hours, you know, because that place, you know, worked very hard and prided itself on the level of dedication. So there were some parts of the process, like, again, I thought it was weird how, and that's stayed true through the agencies I've been at here. So maybe it's just how they work here, or maybe it's just how BBH London is different. But, and I still find it a bit weird that, like, the in London, I used to love, like, that first creative review where the ideas are their most sort of nascent and unformed and raw, and you've got a junior team presenting to the CCO. Mm-hmm. And you're there and you're, like, respectful because you've got, you know, it's a creative review. So you got to let them sort of speak first. But then here, when you get to reviews, oh, the CDs have already reviewed it. Oh, I see. These are like the highlights. Oh, we don't get to see that. I don't know if that, and I was asking a friend in London, and I think now in London, that's kind of how it works as well. Maybe it was just BBH. I don't know. But I missed that a bit because that felt like, oh, okay. Now, again, a good planner shouldn't be surprised at what he's seeing because you've already been with the team. It's not like you handed the brief and then you come back a week later. Like, you should have been with it. You should develop the trust.
Definitely. Yeah, you're in the trenches.
And so you've seen the work. You've helped shape the work. But it still was a bit of a surprise when it's like the formality of, like, oh, the CDs have seen the work. They've approved it. Now you're seeing it as a kind of a secondary. That was probably the biggest difference. I didn't feel like the day-to-day dynamic or the skills or the tools of the trade
of what I do here was that different
from, or how to get to a brief, or how to write a brief, or how to get to an idea, or how to shape an idea. It didn't feel that different to me.
I tell you a couple of things that I think are quite different, but well, they were certainly for me. The team, the creative team, it's everywhere. It was everywhere for me in London. You didn't talk to a creative that wasn't part of a team. Everyone, you know.
Oh, I see. Yes, the team. And B. Like, you know, Bobby, right. Harry, Sally. Yeah.
Exactly, and. Yeah. It was such a, you know, a good team was the sort of, they had the yin and yang together, and yes. and I didn't sort of see that as consistently as I had when I was in London, and I think that made quite a difference to the type of work I was seeing and the type of way in which people were thinking. It was always to me the people that were closest to a team somehow making better work. It was just, there was something about that. And then the other was the director. The importance of in UK of the commercials director.
Mm.
Not so much here. You know, the work you grew up on in the 90s, and, you know, you think of the names
of the
Glazer, you know, and the Ridley Scotts, and, you know, just a huge part of great advertising.
Yes.
And not here.
That's true. That's very true. I guess that, yeah, the names in London were bigger. And the talent was maybe the ones here, you know, they want to be in Hollywood, not Madison Avenue.
I think Wyden was always, you know, a place where they always were. Someone told me that they thought that Wyden's most aggressive department in Portland was the production department, because they'd always push back on creatives who wanted to use the same director talent, and they'd always bring them someone new because they knew it would change the workup. I always thought that was really interesting. But yeah, I think there's sort of in England, there seemed to be an openness at the third. It was a third creative partner. And here I'm not so sure that there's a willingness to go execute the script as I see it. I don't want your your treatment, you know.
Yes. I've
heard that a lot of times. And anyway, maybe times have just changed, and maybe the whole world.
They take it further down the line here. I mean, again, also, I was closer personally to the to that part of things with the, because I was in Campman for 5 years. Yeah, yeah. So I got more into treatments, and like, I loved the edit. That's also part of what I missed switching to planning was I love film and just being part of, like, you're on a shoot, you're watching this legend.
You're seeing the rough cuts, and you're involved in a lot of, a lot of decisions of being made.
I mean, exactly.
I was at McKenna, well, that's where I sort of started, and we had a huge clash between the planning department and creative department over planners should be involved in casting.
Yeah, interesting.
Well, because you know, it changes, it could change the whole thing, you know. So anyway, yeah. So how long have you been at Wieden then for? Yeah.
So I came to Wieden, it will be 7 years in July.
Okay, cool. What did you join to work on?
So I joined to work on Lyft. So they'd recently won Lyft. I was actually, in between I was at BBDO and very happy there. I was very happy there. Another, you know, holding company, big network, but you know, executed really well. Some greats there, like David Lubars in the creative department, got to work quite closely with him. And I was very happy, but there was a guy, Dan Hill, who was the head of strategy, Wieden New York, just a Brit, another Brit, you know, planner. I'd met him through a friend a year before. We'd had a drink. We have another drink at the year for anyone that's worked down in Soho, my favorite pub. The closest a pub gets to like that Adland pub, which I was going to say one thing.
The Ear Inn.
The Ear Inn, oldest pub. That was one big shift that is less about the work, more about the culture. Like, I missed the Adland part of working in London, right? The physical part of Soho.
I was right outside BBH the other day, actually.
Yeah.
And there's a pub opposite.
The Blue Post, I spent more of my income on the Blue Post.
You could crawl to the pub or crawl back.
Exactly. They talked about buying it for years. And so I missed the social side. But the Ear Inn is always full of advertising people. You can spill out onto the streets. They don't tell you off. And when the sun sets over the Hudson, it's one of the best pubs in New York. So it was me and Dan for a drink in the Ear Inn. And he said, look, you know, would love to bring you to Wieden. I said, oh, no, that's not why I'm here. I was just having a drink. He goes, I know. But, you know, I said, oh, no, honestly, I appreciate that. But I'm really happy at BBDO. I'm doing AT&T. He's like, yeah, you know, why don't you just come in and meet? Just come in and meet some people. And he very sort of gradually, you know, sort of reeled me in. I said, well, look, there's no harm in meeting people. I came in, I met a few people, you know, a couple of creative directors. I met Neil, the MD at the time, and a couple of account people. And again, then they made me an offer that night. And the thing that struck me most is just how nice everyone was. And that sounds really like soft, but it is important because I'm sure we'll talk a bit about the culture at Wieden, but like that was the main thing that struck me. I go, God, everyone's so nice. And these are senior people. So I was thinking, and they make me an offer and I go, oh God, but I don't know, you know, I'm worried because I'm in a good spot and I like BBDO and I've built 2 years of credibility there, and I just feel, you know, why leave a good thing? And I remember calling my recruiter who got me to New York in the first place, Sally, and I always appreciate this because she knew nothing about this drink. It wasn't through her, so I had to first go, look, I haven't been looking around, but I just had a drink with Dan. And anyway, they made me an offer, and I don't know. She goes, go to Wieden. Go. Do not even think twice about it. Go. No one's ever regretted it. I go, really? Oh, but she was honestly tested. So yeah, I remember telling my wife, I go, well, you know, and then she's like, just go to Wieden and maybe I should think about this. And anyway, long story short,
I went to Wieden, and it, in a non-cheesy way, like it has been such a transformative place in so many ways. It is as special as people say it is. It is the culture, right? It is the culture you create, the way you put people first. I mean, you put the work, you know, it's about the work, but the work, you get to the work by looking after the people, and the two are never in conflict. And all those mantras that they talk about, that, you know, walking stupid every day, which they have in the office in London, ship of fools, all the kind of mantras are not about professionalism. They're about individualism. They're about embracing,
bringing yourself to the
full self to work, about having a point of view and others creating a safe space so that you can have that point of view, about being the best you can be. You know, people come to make the best work of their life. So you read all that when you come in, and you know, it can be intimidating. Oh my God, you know, but it's also not intimidating, because it's all about just be yourself, be an idiot, do what you like. You know, we embrace that, put that crazy idea up in the air, and you know, see what happens. So it's been a very special place. And then, yeah, did Lyft for a year, which was awesome. You know, they were again, it was exciting to work with a sort of more of a startup tech, Silicon Valley. We'd go to San Francisco a lot. It was hard though, because it was hard to, you realize it was hard to justify brand and brand advertising, and, you know, versus the performance advertising, which they were used to some engineers, right? They were engineer driven, performance marketing driven culture. And so suddenly this ad agency in New York is going, oh, let's do these things. And it's not seeing instant return. The marketing team were awesome, but again, they were sort of disempowered in a way by the leadership. And it's just, that's just the nature. I mean, I'm sure you've been on the West Coast. You recognize this intimately. Yeah. And so we did that for a year, and then jumped on the Ford pitch, which was fascinating, because I'd spent a year talking to Lyft, who were talking about a future without drivers, and, you know, the end of the car in terms of the personally owned car and the end of the car companies, right? And then we stopped working with Lyft. That relationship ended, and then we're pitching Ford, and we're saying to them, you're Ford, right? You invented the car industry. Don't let those upstarts in Silicon Valley talk about the end of cars and the end of car companies, and, you know, people like Elon Musk. And there was some great, like, part as part of giving them a point of view, right? What do you stand for in this world? Something Wieden talks a lot about is like, what's your truth? And then what's your point of view? It was like, you should have a point of view on the future of the car industry. Are you going to leave it to Elon Musk, who was toxic then?
It's even more toxic now.
I'm probably getting in trouble for saying that. You know, we pitched Tesla next week. Well, we're not going to pitch Tesla because we've got Ford, so I'm all right. And
it felt like such an
obvious message to go, you know, when the world invents, and all the stuff you were reading at the time, like everyone's getting into self-driving cars, and we
had some of the sort of headlines in the pitch.
We said, look,
when you're getting into a
self-driving car, you know, do you want to trust that guy over there in Silicon Valley who's growth at all costs and all that philosophy? Would you trust the people who've been
building safe cars for,
you know, 100 plus years? So we help give them a bit of confidence, right? And to sort of hold their heads up a bit more. It was an awesome experience. And again, we got to, again, building on that theme of confidence, we got to the sort of the positioning around Built Ford Proud, right? Our name's above the door. Still, the family is still very much involved in, you know, the chairman is, you know, William Ford the Third, and they're still very involved. Like it's really a family business, right? Their name is above the door. And so you should, you know, you should reestablish the kind of authority that a Ford, that Ford should have.
It's interesting because I was looking a couple of days ago at some work you guys did for Dodge. It was the Dodge.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I was just thinking how good that work was, you know, just like work you don't kind of see car companies do. You know, it's sort of, it's like reminding us of where they came from and who they are and what they're about in a world where all these cars are looking the same. It seems to give a brand a voice, give it a history, give it a heritage, put a story around it. It's so hard to see any ads in that space that do that, you know?
Yeah. It's true.
So then you get asked by McDonald's to pitch. Is that?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So this is a year after that, a year and a bit. Dan is still at Wyden. There's news of a really secret pitch. I'm going to get him in trouble now for letting slip the secret. But, you know, we're having a beer and I said, what's this secret pitch you're doing? And he said, I really can't tell you. And I was like, oh, come on, you know. So he tells me, at the minute I hear the word McDonald's, I said, McDonald's? You have to let me work on that. I mean, yeah, like there are passion brands and there are big brands, but I love this brand. Like, you have to let me work on this brand. He goes, no, honestly, like, I can do this plus you have to let me work on it. So he said, sure, you know, I mean, how can I say no to that? And that was, look, it was a 9-month pitch, right? It was a long pitch. I joined, you know, maybe a month in, I think we've told this story again. I always say I'm going to get in trouble for stuff. I speak too freely, but there were sort of two big global CEO meetings in this pitch. One was halfway through and one was at the end. And we get to halfway through and we present a load of stuff and it goes terribly. It goes terribly. And I say, I'm speaking to my boss and I said, look, had in mind to maybe do some research, you know, in these 9 months. And if they say we're too New York, why don't I just get a planner and we'll go out of the New York bubble and we'll go and, you know, maybe I'll do a road trip. I'll find a good, you know, place to go and we'll document it and we'll meet real people outside of New York. And look, at worst, we have some pitch theater. Look, we went out, we met people. And at best, maybe we actually learned something, you know, really interesting. And he's like, absolutely, do it. So like a week later, I hit the road with a planner, Janae, who was literally had joined a week prior. So it was kind of amazing for her as an intern, but she was the perfect person for it. And yeah, we hit the road, do like 6 states in 7 days. It was the most sort of, I figured out the most bang for your buck, the most states for your buck you can get in
most McDonald's in a week. In your journey.
Exactly. Big cities, small towns. We did it all. We did like Casey, Illinois, population 2000 to like Atlanta.
How are you talking to people? How are you getting a hold of people? You got a camera?
So we did it super stripped down. You know, I'd done a lot of ethnographies where you had a research vendor would do it. You had a cameraman, you had clients, you had clipboards. And we didn't want to do, well, we couldn't do any of that. We didn't really have the budget to do any of that. But we also realized how much better it is to not do any of that, to be honest. We just started talking to people. And you know, the obvious place would be in McDonald's. So we started in McDonald's. And it would just be, you know, we'd take the phone out. We'd say, we're going to record this, but very discreetly, nothing, very unobtrusive, right? You've got the phone, you're recording. And then Janae would take some photos. Janae would take some photos as we're discussing. But we intentionally made it. We would have the phone down. I'm recording that bit again. We'd have the phone down, very unobtrusive. We're going to record this. But it's just a conversation between two people in a restaurant. And then Janae would take some photos, again, very unobtrusively. But we realized that talking to people at McDonald's isn't the best place because people might want to be there for like 10 minutes. They got a quick lunch break. They don't have an hour and a half to luxuriate about their town and their food and their, you know, eating habits. So we started broadening it out. And again, Janae was brilliant for this. She'd worked in bars her whole life. She's like, we've got to hit the barwoman, talk to them. They're like the sort of maven for the town. They know everything. They know everyone. Then at the bar, you meet other people at the bar. Well, hey, can we buy you a drink? Can we buy you dinner?
So once we broadened it out, once we introduced some alcohol into the mix, to be honest, we
also broadened the context, right?
We spoke to mums in Walmart. We went to church in Alabama, in Birmingham, on a Sunday, and then spoke to the pastor. We went to a fine dining restaurant and then ended up in the kitchens with a chef. Like, we got all these different perspectives, and they made the whole thing, just gave it so much more texture. And then the photography was awesome. We're in like a larder with him holding up a turkey wing, and we've got a quote from him about ingredients. And we've got, and
we did again, we did a week, we did maybe 60 interviews. We had a lot of fun. I probably
had the most fun I've had at the time. I was, what, 15 years in, probably the most fun week I'd had in my whole career, just being out there meeting people and driving through cornfields. Back to the discovering America part, I mean, to have a week to drive, do a road trip, you know, 1,000 miles, and it was awesome. And yeah, we go back and we record all the, we transcribe all the interviews,
and we start just pulling out these moments, memories, rituals,
behaviors, right? All these anecdotes that people had, right? Oh, McDonald's for me is when I was at high school and the team would get like 50 McChickens and 50 cheeseburgers and the coach would like give them on the bus. Oh, McDonald's for me was my first date with my wife. Oh, McDonald's for me was blah, 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 blah.
It might be product truths.
Oh, McDonald's for me is a strawberry milkshake when I'm 8, which is probably my, I think I wrote that one about myself when I'm in London with my mum shopping. McDonald's for me is like late night salvation. That was also me. But there were others that weren't me. And we got,
you know, someone at Wyden in the art department
found beautiful photographs. Well, we either used the real photographs that Janae took, so half of them was just the real people, and then we found some other photos to bring a certain memory to life, which it was either then or soon after we coined the term fan truth. So it was like these fan truths from all these, I think we call them community truths initially, and then simpler fan truth.
This become an internal document that you shared with the team internally first?
It was, so to be honest, it was, no, we went straight into like, let's,
we only had a week before the next pitch meeting. And so we packaged it up into this book. And we said, look, why don't we just have this on the wall, which I'm sure this was a push from Dan. You know, let's get this in a book, and we can just say, look, you know, here, you know, and say, look, I went out, huh?
We've done this. We've been out. We've done it.
Well, that was the exercise, right?
We and once we started putting these things in a book, we realized just how rich an exercise it was, right? It went way further than some pitch theater. It was
really the soul of the brand,
right? If the exercise was, you know, you question whether we know your brand. Well, we went out there and we met people and we
documented it, and we think this is your brand.
Point at the wall, right? This is your brand right here, right? And all these moments, memories, rituals, behaviors. And so we did that, but it was too late at that point to influence the work for that round of, so it was a little bit disjointed, right? It's like we did this and then here's some work that had already, yeah. So that first, so, and I remember we show the clients this stuff, and it was, yeah, they just looked and they were like, wow, that's,
no one's ever done that before.
Like they never, you know, they had so much research, they'd had so much quant, they'd had so much, but they never got to these simple truths around, you know, their brand. And that's it. I mean, that book
remains at the heart of
everything we do for the brand. Like it's
so rare that like you do
something in a pitch that then lives in, you know,
pretty much.
What I think so interesting is, you know, it sort of speaks a lot to the way the world of communication has changed. Like, you know, we it's all to do with authorship, right? You know, like the old world of somebody pushing a message at you that they think is right for you, versus people going on TikTok and seeing these stories from people like them. It seems that we've gone, like, we've made a leap. And in a way, what you guys did was to sort of, you sort of caught that, but it could be really uninteresting if it's just that, right? I'm sure you had those debates internally, like how do you take these real truths and add some drama, make them interesting? And, you know, that's the art of it, right? It's otherwise it's just flat. There's something it's got to resonate. Okay, this has to be a truth that resonates, but then you have to make it. How is someone going to pay attention to that?
Yeah. In a way, what's fascinating, and I think you're really touching on it here, where we'd struggled in the first half of that pitch was trying to make McDonald's stand for this one thing, right? Maybe the closest we got was optimism, right? It's a really optimistic brand. And like we had some beautiful art direction of like through the arches, you know, the world is, and we try to contextualize it. You know, it was what, 2019. So in a time of discord disagreement, you know, we are a place of positivity. And then you had inspirational, motivational posters that were like, hey, you know, step in and the world's okay. And like glass half full, glass half, like there was some cool stuff there. But the problem was trying to make them stand for this big thing. So we got to this place, almost pushed into this place that was much more democratic. And then what that's unlocked, like you say, we rode a wave where I think the industry is kind of shifting anyway. Now you read loads about fans and fandoms and community groups, and we kind of lucked onto it. But once we were there and we had this foundation of fans and fan truths, that informed everything we did, right? And so the shift that my creative directors did from that was, okay, if fan truths are like the truths of the brand, the building blocks, fan to fan is going to be our voice, which was a real nice shift from them. And so everything we do is just one fan speaking to another, right? And so that creates a voice that's very, of the people, or sort of given up to the fans. And then you take it even further beyond that and you go, one of our mantras is share the pen. So everything we do is we share the pen with the fans, right? We put TikTok, we get inspiration from a campaign from what people are doing on TikTok. Oh, people are hacking the menu. That was a few years later. So I'll speak about stuff in chronological order, but like people are hacking the menu on TikTok. All right, let's do a campaign where the brand goes, hack the menu, and we call it Menu Hacks. And we're encouraging people to hack the menu. That behavior would have been alien to the brand some years before. What, a big corporation is going to encourage people to hack the menu? Are you crazy? But again, if you embrace this fan to fan, there's another great example. I don't know if you don't have imagery, right? You know, you don't, but people can picture it. There's a really great example when we first did the Travis Scott meal. So that was a year after we won the pitch, right? We win the pitch October 2019. And then, obviously we went through the roller coaster of the COVID, the height of COVID, you know, media was slashed, work was change, the calendar gets blown up, but we get to end of 2020, and the brand really wanted to invest. The CEO down had said, I want to invest in a big marketing idea, so what you got, Wyden, kind of thing. And we came up with this, we'd done an ad in the Super Bowl that was just before COVID, so February 2020, that was to the fan truth. No matter how big or famous you are, everyone has a McDonald's order, right? It's something we all have in common. And we all eat the same quarter pounders, and, you know, to the Andy Warhol Coke quote, right? It's the same Coke, whether you're Marilyn Monroe or the president. So
we did that, and we saw how there was a lot of,
we had like Kim Kardashian, and we had famous footballers, and we had Magic Johnson, and we had Whoopi Goldberg.
And that really resonated online.
Like we saw on social media, the fans that, you know, embraced him.
And so when we got this giant brief from the
CEO, one of the ideas, and we went back with some classic Wyden kind of nuts ideas, but that's why, you know, I love working at this place. And they go, like, oh, I don't know if that's right, or we're looking for a platform, you know. And then we came back with a really simple build on the Super Bowl spot. We went, well, what if we just took the famous orders idea and we just made one, and we said, look, now you can come in store and buy, you know, the Kim Kardashian or the whatever. And that was it. Clients were like, that's it, that's the one. Then we had to find out who is the right person to do this with. And again, people far cooler than me, far younger than me, said Travis Scott was the name that sort of bubbled up, rose to the top. And we launched that in September, end of September 2020. But we'd only come up with it a few months before. There was no time to do like package. You know, now with everyone, we do like packaging. You can have Travis Scott cup and you can have bags and you can have, there was nothing we had time to do. And people start framing the receipts. Yeah. Like people were framing the receipts because that was the only bit that was different within their quarter pound meal. People started stealing. We have videos of people stealing the point of sale posters from the front of the restaurants. And again, that unlocked so much for us and the clients because we went, oh, okay, the right idea can be so hot. People are stealing your point of sale post. Like the right intersection between this ginormous brand that everyone in the world knows and loves and some aspect of culture that's hot right now, and you fuse those together, holy shit, like you can create some real fire in that. But what was the reason I mentioned the Travis Scott thing, you know, we've shown this slide in presentations, my client shows it. It was like the merch. So the only thing we could do that was sort of designed bespoke was do some merch, which you could launch with a campaign. You wouldn't receive it for like 8 weeks later, but at least we could show people this stuff. And so our design department put some designs together following the McDonald's brand guidelines to the letter of the law. And it's got white and it's gold and the logo is used in the right way and the font's correct. And Travis Scott saw it and went, what the hell is that? I'm not gonna wear that. That looks like corporate stuff you get free at a thing, right? He goes, I've got some of my own designs. So he shows us his designs. And we went, oh, I mean, you can't do that. And like, we haven't used that logo for 20 years and we can't do that packaging. And he's like, this is cool. And again, it takes a lot of, we talk about creative bravery with our clients a lot. Like it takes a lot of bravery to go, okay, I'm going to throw the guidelines out the window because there's something really special here because we're going to share the pen. So that was when share the pen, you realize the power of it. It's like share the pen with one of your biggest fans who happens to be one of the hottest sort of, you know, talent in the world right now and let him express what this brand means to him. Don't try and force it. So again, that's why
fans reinterpret it yourselves.
Yeah, don't try and interpret it. Don't relinquish control and look what happens when you relinquish control. And that merch blew up. Again, it sold out. Four drops sold out. And I see people in the street, credible people, wear the Travis Scott. And I, you know, that's, I was going to say, like, I think for any of us that love the product we make, the work and love the industry, the real value is not in awards. And we talk about this a while, and we don't care about awards. You know, everyone cares about awards to an extent. You want to get some validation, whether it's creative awards, you want to get effectiveness awards that show the industry or show other people that, yeah, we did work that works. But for me, the biggest validation is when you just meet normal people in the street, you know, civilians in the street, and they're wearing a Travis Scott t-shirt. Or, you know, I met a kid in, there was a kid in France last summer who was wearing one. And like, we didn't run the campaign in France, but through the resale and stuff, and I went, oh, Travis Scott. He goes, ah, yeah, super chic or super cool or whatever that is in France. And I said, oh, we did that in, you know, and that's where you feel your work has actually made an impact.
It's also really interesting that you know, someone, it's going back to that nuance thing we started talking about, which is you can say that it's a big umbrella and everyone can fit under it, and that's the great thing about the brand, or you can actually do it, and you know what I mean, and the doing is so much more powerful than the saying.
Right. Exactly, 100%.
You've got to find this universal truth, and then, you know, everyone gets them, but then you amplify them with these celebrities, and it just sort of like, it becomes of a flywheel.
Exactly. The, in terms of, you know, insight and execution, or idea and execution, it's like if the starting point is truth, is a fan truth, literally, And you can go to some
pretty wild places,
but the foundation is true, and therefore the authenticity is there, the brand link is there, and people don't go, why the hell are you doing that? Like, oh, you, it makes sense, right?
We did an adult happy meal, a few years after that, so 2022, we did an adult happy meal to the fan truth of
you're never too old to have a happy meal.
Or there was a lovely, sometimes, again, a fan truth can come in a tweet or can come in something someone else is a tweet. We're always doing social listening to see how are our fans talking about stuff.
And there was this lovely tweet we did that then
got a lot of affection from the internet.
And I'm going to try not to butcher it. It's like the moment you have your last happy meal and you didn't even know it, right? It's something so poignant. I like almost cried at that. I go, oh, God, that goes so deep. Yeah. That goes so deep.
And so that, and we saw how people embraced it, and like, they, you know, art people published articles about why am I crying over a McDonald's tweet about Happy Meals? But like, it's almost profound. I mean, not all our tweets are profound, but it's profound, right? That.
What's so beautiful about it is the flexibility. It can go from this the almost dumb to the really profound.
Yes, exactly.
And it goes up through so that dimensionality of it. So just going back to, you know, there's been a lot of talk, and I just was talking to some folks over in the UK about mm-hmm. about this whole phenomenon of planners getting out the office.
Yeah.
And so do you think that experience changed the way you thought a little bit about the importance of going back out there, and is something that the department or you think has sort of changed the way you guys approach things now?
Absolutely. Personally,
it was transformational. And again, this whole last 4 or 5 years on McDonald's has been an inflection point in my own career. But the fact that it all started with
this road trip that was also super fun.
I mean, I was telling some of this story to some of the more junior planners literally yesterday at work. And I said, look, we did this,
but also it's the most fun I've
had in like 15 years in working. So look, I never doubted the value of getting out there. It's when I came to America, it's the stuff I most loved. What I think I hadn't fully appreciated was the value of doing it yourself, and also the value of how easy it is to do, because it is. Look, ethnographies are awesome when you go in someone's house, but it's also kind of weird. And there's like 10, not 10 people there. There's like 8 people there, and there's a cameraman.
It's artificial. With their giant,
it's so artificial. And then there's 2 clients who want to come because they're paying for it. And of course they should be there. And then they've got clipboards, and like, that's not. So what's amazing is that we found a way to do it that's so simple and pure. That
has now become part of,
I mean,
that's a formal part of the McDonald's methodology now, right?
And not just us, all our partner agencies in the US, they do road trips as well. And they have, you know, when they first went on their road trip, they will email me and go,
shit, that was the most fun I've
ever had. I go, yeah, no, I know, it's really fun. And just go out. And initially, and again, it was the COVID years as well, so like, it's not the easiest time to do road trips. But initially people were like doing online stuff, Zooms. And I went, look, I get why, you know, but honestly, just try and hit the road and get out there. And then once they did, they go, oh God, it's so fun. But, and so, yeah, not just McDonald's. I mean, I get other accounts in the agency. It's inspired others to go, you know what, I should just go out there. And we're lucky, right? Because we're talking about McDonald's, so we can go to McDonald's. It's a it's harder to go to a, you know, shampoo. But again, some of the best stuff we find is not in McDonald's. So you don't have to be, just go somewhere where you can talk to people, or go somewhere where the occasion is somehow front of mind for whatever product you're talking about. Just go to your local supermarket, right? And just see how people shop, or talk to them. Like it doesn't have to be expensive. You don't have to travel thousands of miles.
So yeah, I fully
encourage that. And again, it's a win-win, because it's fun. And if it doesn't go anywhere, you also haven't spent
know, a fortune, and therefore have to go to the clients, oh, you know what? We sorry, one sec. He's still here?
Yeah.
So we got to a stage where there's kind of a strategist for everything. I mean, you got a AI strategist probably now, and this TikTok strategist, and a brand strategist, and this. What's if someone's is there room for someone who just wants to be a planner? They don't actually have a prefix. They just want to be a planner. Have we got specialized to the point where, you know, if you're not a specialist, you're not involved? What's your thought on that?
I hope so. And I thought your question was actually going to be on the other side, like, is there a need for specialists? And so it's interesting you because in my head I'm like, of course you need the. I think, look, I love that there are specialists out there that can go deep on certain, you know, parts of consumer behavior, certain parts of the media landscape. Like, I don't think you need a specialist for just TikTok, or, you know, to go that niche. I think they would quickly run out of steam. So I love that they're a specialist. What I love about brand planning is that it is sort of, you know, more upstream than it, that, you know, I love to have a team of sort of generalists that might be specialists in certain things, but they are, you know, their interests are broad, their curiosity is broad, their understanding of human behavior and interest in it is broad. And so, like, I you know, I love that we can be at that level and other people can be more tactical and go granular and be experts at, you know, and then you can bring the two together. So I work very closely with our comms partners, with, you know, we have social planners as well, who again can be experts in such a big part of how brands, you know, show up in the world and how they interact with their fans. But I'm not yet worried that the old brand planner is gonna fade away.
What about AI?
AI is tricky. I mean, I suddenly had this existential crisis yesterday. So my wife is she's a consultant, and she's doing a lot about AI, and we're talking about AI, and our clients talking about AI. And I've even bought some shares because they have AI component. And then I just suddenly went, but to what end? I mean, surely the end. I think I said to her, and I'm not the first to say this, it's like, if AI replaces people, then who's going to buy the stuff AI is making? I go, do you guys talk about that? She goes, oh, yeah, no. I mean, that's at the heart of the philosophical debate around AI. I go, well, that's terrifying, right? And so, I mean, it would require a systemic change. Like so I have to be positive. I am a positive person. And I have to go, if AI can empower humans, and if AI can enhance what we do, and if AI can replace the most boring parts, which then allow us to do the more interesting parts, then I have to be hopeful when we can all get reskilled. The worry is when that second part of the equation doesn't happen. And you've seen how, you know, around the world, in the West, or in the more developed countries, what happens is, you know, technology replaces certain people's roles and jobs, and they don't get reskilled, they don't get retrained, and then they're left, or you know, either technology replaces or you trade with cheaper countries and that replaces them.
The model should work
if those people get reskilled, but if they don't, then what happens? And that, so the positive side for me is, if we can all get enhanced and we can all do more, then fantastic. But we have to, the role of society is to protect that change. And God, we got very
you got back very, to LSE big. We got back to LSE for a minute.
Yeah, oh, I love that. I love that.
But just do you think it has a practical application in the daily life of a planner?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean,
is it there to do sort of the get the boring stuff out of the way, or is it there to sort of tell us kind of what we perhaps shouldn't do? Kind of like, to me, it seems like it comes back with the most obvious.
Yeah, thing. We talk about that in my team. Like, get the AI to come up with the obvious insights to then
go beyond that.
Yeah. So there's way absolutely a lot of my team that are younger and more tech savvy. They're already using AI in those ways. So we're still figuring it out. We're figuring out where in the process can you use AI to your benefit, but never feel that AI is going to replace the magic part still going to come from the human. So at least for another few years.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Ed. That was a really, really enjoyable conversation.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.